This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Fourth Estate on Reality Check Radio on this Friday, the 4th of October, 2024. Where we tirelessly follow the droppings and blood trails left by legacy media. Plenty of sign for us to assess and follow this week. We'll discuss the finalised sale last week of The Spectator for £100 million British pounds, the Midwestern Nice vice presidential debate. We'll assess the changing coverage of New Zealand's comparatively high use of puberty blockers. We'll take a look at media coverage, or lack thereof, of Labour's foreign affairs spokesman endorsing the rape, murder and torture of civilians as a legitimate weapon of war. And speaking of weapons of war, Parliament's Finance and Expenditure Committee, the Select Committee, has completed its climate adaptation inquiry. We'll take a look at what it says, what it doesn't say, and how it's being reported. We discuss Kiwi journalists' continuing resentment of Christopher Luxon for being rich and the coverage of Hastings District Council's decision to appoint kids with voting rights on council committees. On a heavier note, we'll close by assessing media coverage of the Iranian missile attack on Israel and Israel's moves against Hezbollah and Hamas. The first of my fellow Kalahari Bushmen on today's hunt is veteran corporate media broadcaster turned free-thinking RCR host, a regular fixture on television screens from the late 1970s to 2018. He delighted audiences but scared management and quit before he was sacked because he wanted to play more golf anyway. Welcome, Peter Williams.
Good morning, Marty. Well put.
And from the other side of the fence, we have one of New Zealand's most experienced management consultants whose specialist skills in governance, public administration, public sector reform and policy development have taken her all over the world. Welcome, Catherine Ennis-Carter.
Good morning, Marty. Nice to be with you again.
Wonderful. Well, first up, bucking the trend of media, apparently media outlets being worth less, we see hedge fund tycoon and backer of GB News, Sir Paul Marshall, has finalised a £100 million takeover of The Spectator magazine, which was earlier valued at £25 million. But this apparently completes the next stage of his ambition to control a significant swathe of the UK's conservative and right-wing media outlets, just at a time when there's all sorts of things happening in Great Britain, which needs scrutiny. He already owns Unheard, the website, and is also in the running to buy the Daily and Sunday Telegraphs. Andrew Neil has stepped down as chairman and made the parting shot that there have been no assurances of continued editorial independence, although Spectator editor Fraser Nelson told Sky News last month he is confident it will continue and there's no reason the conservative magazine can't be worth £150 million. And this sale represents the first stage in recouping the £600 million paid by Redbird IMI, the consortium backed by Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the vice president of the United Arab Emirates and owner of Manchester City Football Club, and the US investment firm Redbird Capital Partners, which took control of the Telegraph Media Group in November last year from the Barclay family. Peter, I remember you wondering in an essay why News Hub hadn't followed News Talk ZB in offering a conservative right-wing perspective that contrasted with the more government, less freedom angle of state broadcasters. Is this another example of this movement being a winning approach?
It would seem so. I don't know how GB News is going, Marty, but certainly The Spectator has been part of British media, British society in many respects, since the early years of the 19th century. This is a famous historical title with some very famous editors over the years. Perhaps in recent times, the most famous of the editors has been Boris Johnson. Mm-hmm. But in recent times, under Fraser Nelson and under the chairmanship of Andrew Neil, The Spectator has become far more than just a British magazine. There is now a very successful Australian version, edited by Rowan Dean. There's, I understand, a quite successful American version. I don't know who the editorial staff involved in that are. But The Spectator is also a classic case of adapting to the modern world. The Spectator has gone from being a print product to an online product, and it has literally millions of subscribers all around the world. That subscriber growth has grown in recent times, particularly during the COVID era and during the era of, shall we say, the rise of left-wing politicians, particularly in Britain with Jeremy Corbyn and then with Sir Keir Starmer. So it just proves once again that there is a solid core of right-leaning, common-sense thinking people who want to consume well-written, well-evidence-based opinion and factual articles. And it's been a very successful product as a consequence of it, with the great subscriber growth all over the world. Now, I'll say unabashedly, I'm a Spectator fan, I'm a subscriber, and I'm not surprised that it is sold for so much. It does seem a quite extraordinary price to pay for just one product, but then this is part of a greater plan on the part of Sir Paul Marshall. You talked about the Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph, and the Sunday Telegraph being up for sale at the moment. I noticed just in the last 3 or 4 days, there have been a couple of bids put through to the current owners of it, who want to offload it. Obviously, they're in it for the money, not for the editorial side of things. Sir Paul Marshall is not one of those whose name has been put forward for the final decision, although I also read that he is still very keen and may come in as a late runner on the outside. But The Spectator was part of the Telegraph Group. There was a plan for the royal family of Qatar to buy it. That was stopped by an act of parliament, who said, no way, Jose, are we going to have, I hate to use this word because I think it's banned from today's show, isn't it, Marty? Totalitarian regimes taking over a section of the British media. So in that respect, that is one good thing that has come out of this whole process. But the Telegraph Group, when it was under the ownership of the Barclay family, was losing money. So there has been a sale and a rationalisation of the business to try and get it back into profit again. But the Spectator has been put off to one side. It was part of the group, but it's been sold separately. Marshall has taken it and insists that he will have no editorial influence. He just wants it to continue on its current very successful editorial direction.
Well, if I didn't talk about aspirant totalitarians, I'd lose so much of my material. So it's certainly not banned, Peter. Catherine, do you follow The Spectator or watch GB News? It was a beacon of hope for me and many times during COVID.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't say I'm a regular reader of The Spectator, but I'm certainly aware of it, and I've read quite a lot of the articles in the Australian Spectator magazine, and found them very objective and interesting articles much of the time. But I'm also interested in the fact that Paul Marshall owns the Unheard website. Now, I've found this website is releasing some very interesting articles about everything, everything to do from global politics to a number of the issues that the freedom movement generally is concerned about since the COVID era. And Unheard has been bombing my inbox since I first discovered it. There's an incredible amount of articles featured on it. So I'm very interested that he is buying up the Spectator magazine.
I've probably seen a lot of Unheard articles, but until I started looking at this yesterday, I hadn't been consciously aware of them. Moving to more conventional news, the sole U.S. vice presidential debate between Trump's running mate J.D. Vance and Kamala Harris's running mate Tim Walz. We saw a ban on fact-checking that was then apparently overturned, and there was a bit of fact-checking done, which led to J.D. Vance protesting and his mic being cut. It was billed as very Midwestern nice, wasn't it? I struggle to warm to Walz. I often find the Democrats use these old white men like an actual vaccine in a way that COVID shots aren't. You take a weakened strain of what you're trying to eliminate and you inject it in the hope of building resistance to it. Did you watch the whole debate, Catherine?
No, well, I couldn't stand to watch the whole thing. I did watch quite a lot of it. And it made me extraordinarily depressed because the whole American election has just turned into such a complete circus. And what I found, I've talked on RCR before about the prevalence of hypocrisy in so many areas of society and governance recently. But it was just another display of that. The lies and deceit were almost palpably obvious. Mm. You know, the fake empathy shown by both of them. I thought that Vance probably, you know, if you want to score points, I thought he probably won the debate, was more convincing. But, it was just so much of it was fake, you know, fake empathy, fake so-called policy announcements, and a lot of it was particularly from the Democrat side was, look what I've done in Minnesota, and that went on and on. But the policy debate, you know, was in the weeds, things that are not going to make any real difference, and of course, you know, picking the things that most polarise society, and like the abortion debate. It was just really depressing and just an absolute display of the total circus that American politics has become.
Mm.
It was awful.
Peter, did you really enjoy it?
Well, I tried to. I sat down because the weather down here on that particular day was not flash, Wednesday afternoon. It wasn't even good enough to play golf, Marty. So I had to give up my Wednesday afternoon golf game, and I thought I'll come home and watch the presidential, vice presidential debate. It started at 2 o'clock, massive build up, a panel discussion beforehand, you know, a talk fest before a talk fest. And then, of course, came the talk fest after the talk fest. Once it started at 2 o'clock, I found myself on the couch, Marty, nodding off. It was just, it just wasn't particularly exciting. There was no fireworks. Having said that, from what I did glean between naps, J.D. Vance is a very, very accomplished political performer. I thought Walz taking notes, stumbling, bumbling, looking very nervous, was not an accomplished political performer.
Describing himself as a knucklehead?
yeah. I think Vance, it's been said since that debate that Vance is the future of the Republican Party. And I think despite what will happen in this year's election, Vance will be the Republican candidate in 4 years' time. So I think that you're looking at a future American president here, whether it's 2028, whether it's 2032, I don't know. He's only 40 years of age, so he's got a long time in front of him. So I suspect that Vance is going to be a dominant player in American politics for a long time to come. A very smooth performer, a very accomplished performer. And after all, if you can be fluent and confident and have that on-screen charisma, you're going to be a very successful political operative. And in that respect, Vance wiped the floor with Walz in terms of the outcome of that debate.
Yeah, I guess it depends whether the Democrats get in and let another 20 million undocumented immigrants into the country and then give them voting rights. Whether or not those people vote for J.D. Vance, I guess, will be pivotal on determining.
Well, that, of course, was the most disgraceful part of that debate. Those two women who ran it just wanted to make me put two fingers down my throat. I thought they were shockers. And there was Vance trying to explain this app that Haitian immigrants can get on their US government supplied iPhones that they can open to get themselves legal residence in the United States. And there was poor old Walls trying to say, well, that law's been in place since 1990. That didn't sound too good because, as far as I understand, apps and smartphones didn't exist in 1990. Just one small point there. But anyway, I thought that the way that Vance was shut down at that particular stage of the debate when he was trying to explain something very rational and very detailed, very factual, was very unfair on the part of those smarmy female moderators.
Mm. The thing that looms large for me over the coming US election is Mike Benz's observation that the two most censored news stories that he's seen in a very intense study of censored news stories are COVID and mail-in ballots.
Yeah.
Postal
ballots for the US election are just outrageous. And then the whole concept of you needed ID to be able to go to the Democratic convention, to be able to get through the door at the Democratic convention, but you don't need ID to vote in the presidential election. I mean, go figure. Is that hypocrisy in double standards or what?
Well, yeah, and possibly even more sinister than that. Next up, we're going to have a look at the study that was published last week.
Just before we leave that, can I just make one more comment about that debate? I'm afraid that I had a kind of a visceral reaction to the idea of Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. Being what we might face for the next 4 years if they win the election. Because, I couldn't help thinking that Tim Walz looked a bit like, he had a sort of possum in the headlights look a lot of the time. It sort of startled big eyes and a wide mouth like a Muppet that sort of flaps and doesn't really say anything. The thought of Kamala Harris's hysterical laughter and vacuous statements and this guy's Muppet flapping. Is that what we're going to have for the next 4 years? I hate to think.
I hope not.
There are always going to be vacuous people. There are always going to be Muppet flapping people. The depressing thing for me is that there are people who will vote for it.
Yes,
and I have to live with them.
Please, America, don't give us that.
Well, let's get on to another thing that we've been given. This study that was published last week in the New Zealand Medical Journal, which appears that the ground's shifting in the coverage of New Zealand's disproportionately high use of puberty blockers. We saw some pretty solid coverage from Radio New Zealand, and it's quite a precedent. They put less attention on the pro-gender affirming care crowd's criticism of the study. As we have come to expect, I suppose Stuff's take was that it's all normal and natural, and the Herald's wasn't too bad, although it still talks about transgender children, which is always an odd thing to my ears. Looking at some of what the study showed, the use of puberty blockers increased from 2011. When guidelines for the use to treat gender-related distress were introduced, and it accelerated rapidly between 2014, but then it started to fall from 2022. And for those aged 12 to 17, first use was fewer than six each year from 2006 to 2008, but it increased steeply to 148 before declining, and first used among those aged 0 to 11. And I can't imagine how that works. Also rose steeply and fell, but it's unclear what proportion of this use was for gender dysphoria. So there's a lot going on with that. Have you been following this, and did you look at the particularly in the wake of the CAS report, which received very little coverage, this seems to be a turning tide possibly, or am I being too optimistic?
Well, certainly that piece by Ruth Hill on the Radio New Zealand website was very thorough, and I thought a very good examination of the facts. What struck me in that report, though, Marty, was how small this problem is. I mean, if you're talking about the prescription of puberty blockers to just a few hundred children in the teenage years, that's nothing. There are hundreds of thousands of teenagers in this country. And here we're talking about a prescription which started off, what did you say, at six up until 2018. And then since then, it's been up to 400 and something. That's still a minuscule amount. So therefore, this is not that big a deal. Having said that, I want to see some reaction from the Minister of Mental Health, Matt Ducey, from the Minister of Health. I'd like to see some comment from the Prime Minister about it, because even though it's only a few hundred children being affected, those are a few hundred children who may not be able to fully enjoy the joys of adulthood when they get through puberty. So it is a serious issue. However, I reiterate the fact that it is not a widespread medical problem. It involves just a few hundred children amongst hundreds of thousands. So therefore you wonder, why does it get the media coverage, the media prominence that it does?
Well, there were 14 young people killed in the Cave Creek disaster. And if you contrast the coverage of that and the subsequent laws that were passed and regulations that were changed to prevent it happening again, it puts a few hundred into perspective.
But having said that, well done, Radio New Zealand, not known for its balance on many occasions with its reporting. Well done to Ruth Hill in particular for a very thorough background to the story and how it stands at the moment. And inevitably at the end, the government, the Minister of Health, the Minister of Mental Health has been approached for comment. He did not reply, was the inference from that. And the continuing silence out of the beehive is the most disgraceful aspect of this whole story, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and the fact that the mental health minister used to work for the Tavistock Institute, was actively involved in that. And Christopher Luxon, having described people's concerns about their young daughters potentially sharing changing rooms with grown men, Christopher Luxon described anyone who was worried about that as out in space or on another planet, sorry. And once you get into the weeds on this, there's one comment in the Radio New Zealand article. Surgeons have also pointed out blockers have made gender-affirming surgery more difficult, as there is less tissue available if pubertal development is frozen. And what that speaks to, if you're interested in this issue, Paul Brennan did a marvellous interview on RCR with Stella O'Malley, who's a psychotherapist and executive director of GenSpect. I think it was around September the 12th of this year. And she pointed out that if a boy takes puberty blockers, his penis doesn't grow beyond what a child's is. So there are real issues leading out from this that children really don't know enough to consent to. Catherine, what about this from a
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, I can't help but be slightly encouraged by the fact that there seems to be some shift since the CAS report. And there is some more elevated concerns, I think, about the use of puberty blockers and the whole transgender ideology. But you only have to listen to RCR has actually done some really good interviews just very recently about the Midwifery Council, and that is an illustration of just how crazy things have got, where every reference to woman, baby, mother is being removed from the language of all their guidelines and publications, and substituted with the word whānau. And you know the even this current pronouncement about the use of puberty blockers reducing, the whole thing is still underpinned with a very grudging move away and or a very grudging acceptance that there is something to be concerned about here, which is the extent that illustrates the extent to which this whole transgender craziness has taken over. But I want to mention an interesting thing. About 2007, I watched a BBC documentary about body dysmorphia, and part of the documentary featured people who have a kind of a morbid obsession that they want to be amputees. And apparently some psychologists had determined that this affliction can't be treated with normal psychological methods. So there were doctors and we're starting to advocate that if people had an obsession with wanting to be an amputee, that hospitals could actually amputate the limbs, and that would make these people happy that they had achieved this bodily state that they had an obsession to achieve. And there are all these things, you know, it's reminiscent now of what's being talked about kids who commit suicide if they're not allowed to transition to another gender. And this argument was being put forward at that time, and there was a hospital in Scotland that was starting to undertake these surgeries, cutting off legs and whatever. And in the end, the hospital board put a stop to it because they didn't want their hospital becoming the centre for these kind of surgeries. So you really wonder why that kind of objective common sense attitude can't prevail in the medical establishment today, and you know why we've had this ideologically driven agenda taking hold and being promoted within both the medical establishment and through social norms and social advocates. Why a more common sense approach can't be positioned.
And because we aim to educate on the Fourth Estate, I can share with our listeners that the term for wanting to have one's limbs amputated is apotemnophilia. So that's one to steer clear of.
Thank you for that. I'll make sure I keep my pots in the cupboard.
Well, if we're finished with that, in other weird takes news, let's look at the coverage of a retweet by Labour's Associate Foreign Affairs spokesperson Damien O'Connor of a tweet that said Hamas had every right to do what they did on October 7th last year when they murdered, raped, tortured, and kidnapped over 1,000 Israeli civilians. David Farrar had great analysis on Kiwi Blog on Tuesday, pointing out that the media treatment for this was incredibly light. And he said New Zealand Herald staff and Radio New Zealand did run stories on it, but simply reported that there had been criticism and the tweet has been deleted. Peter, were you surprised that this didn't become a bigger story?
No.
Right.
Because the media in this country are left-leaning and Labour-supporting. So you can't, for heaven's sake, run stories that are critical of Damien O'Connor, even if Damien O'Connor is one of the normally more sensible and, shall we say, more right-leaning members of the Labour Party, and was a moderately successful, in my opinion, Minister of Agriculture, and didn't do a bad job as Minister of Trade when he held those portfolios. But this was completely beyond the pale. I see he's quickly deleted it, and this morning he has made some more comments about the tweet, basically saying I shouldn't have done it, still not apologising for the sentiments expressed in it. David Farah has pointed out quite logically that, remember back in 2020 when Todd Muller had that very ill-fated time as leader of the National Party, he was castigated for having a MAGA hat in his office glass cabinet. He also had a Hillary Clinton badge there. The point is that Todd Muller was a bit of a geek as far as American politics were concerned, had made some trips to the States and had picked up some souvenirs from the 2016 campaign there. There was, to my mind, nothing more sinister than that, but that was really the beginning of the end as far as Todd Muller's leadership of the National Party was concerned. Absolutely castigated, story after story, night after night on the TV news, that Todd Muller had the temerity to have a MAGA hat in his office cabinet. Now, Damien O'Connor does something which is far, far worse, in that he is essentially actively supporting murder, rape, pillage, terrorism, and yet he seems to get away with it scot-free from the New Zealand media, and that is the most disgraceful aspect of this whole incident. Damien O'Connor lost his seat in the last election. I don't think down in West Coast Tasman this particular play of his is going to go down too well, and whoever his opponent's going to be in the next election might do well, and that's more impure, I would imagine, might do well to just bring this one out of the cupboard come the 2026 election as well. I mean, Damien O'Connor to be uttering any public comment in support of Hamas, in support of terrorism, is despicable and disgraceful, and frankly, he should be hung, drawn, and quartered for it, figuratively, not literally, but because we don't want to get into hate speech on this program.
No.
No. But O'Connor to basically get away with it as far as the mainstream media is concerned is just disgraceful.
Catherine?
Oh, dear. Well, you know, I've spent quite a few years living in Islamic countries. I've lived in Pakistan for a good few years. I've lived in Turkey. I've travelled extensively through the Middle East. And I really hate the way that this whole debate becomes so polarised, and also why people feel that if your sympathies are with one side for whatever reason, then you have to be totally opposed to the other side. So the whole debate about the Israel-Hamas conflict, and now with Hezbollah, has become so polarised, but it's also a very ignorant debate that's taking place. And a lot of the people who are making noises about the current situation, they just come from a perspective that what Israel is doing in Gaza and in Lebanon is terrible, and they're committing genocide and all of this. And so in taking that view, and the international community has become, or at least Western countries have become, dominated by an extraordinary amount of tolerance towards Islam and its excesses. But there is, it seems to be almost universal hatred of Israel. And of course, you know, everybody, nobody now takes account of the whole historical perspective. And once again, what happened in 1948 with the establishment of the Jewish state, was a solution to the problem of what had happened during the Second World War and before, with the build-up of, in the 30s, there were thousands of people going to Israel because of what was taking place in Europe. And then, of course, after the war, the establishment of Israel was internationally, you might say, a sop to the Jews. It was also the resolution for what to do with all the millions of displaced Jews in Europe, which, despite the Holocaust, nobody wanted. The UK didn't want more Jewish immigrants, and neither did the countries where a lot of people who were moved across Europe during the war under the Final Solution had ended up in countries like Poland. Poland didn't want them either. So I was reading something recently where the writer was making the point that the international community are the moral heirs of the whole Holocaust guilt. But it seems to have turned, I think Islamic propaganda has been very deliberate and quite successful since the 1979 Iranian Islamic Revolution. And Iran since then has had a stated policy of the eradication of Israel. And they're accomplishing it through these various insurgent actions with Islamic terrorist groups. And nobody who talks about it really talks about that background. It's all analysed now from a present state position, which, and if you see, you know, a lot of the young people demonstrating, they seem to think that Palestine was an independent state in 1948, which the Jews invaded and overthrew. And of course, you know, the Jewish state was established, and there was before and after that constant conflict between the Muslims and the Jews in Israel. But the international community has never taken a stance and publicly castigated Iran for its position and stating that its policy is the eradication of Israel. And people talk about, you know, the ceasefire without any indication, without, you know, that they have an awareness of what would happen if mantras like, you know, from the river to the sea, Israel shall be free, you know, that there would be a bloodbath in Israel. And then what will happen after that is that those forces who want the whole of the Middle East to be a Islamic caliphate, then what will happen is that once Israel is done away with, and there'll be a bloodbath there, but then the Sunnis and the Shias will fight each other for who controls the caliphate.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing that is never mentioned, all this business. And Winston Peters is probably as guilty as anybody when he says that we want a two-state solution, the two states being Palestine and Israel. Palestine will never be a united state because there are two aspects, two factions in Palestine that hate each other, namely the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. And no way will they ever come together to have one united Palestine state. So that is a fantasy as things stand at the moment, surely.
Well, let's park that discussion and let's talk about some of the stuff that's going on that's not widely covered while we're preoccupied with the Middle East and boys who want to be girls. The report on the inquiry into climate change adaptation. And I know this is very much in your wheelhouse, Catherine. Do you want to pivot to that? Let's talk about things closer to home.
Well, you know, again, this is fascinating. recently, you know, well, since the COVID years, you know, we've been seeing these various reports on things that sort of sometimes appear out of nowhere, even though there has been a sort of a boiling the frog about to them. So this is very interesting. So the completion of the climate inquiry, or the inquiry into climate adaptation report, was presented to the Parliamentary Finance and Expenditure Committee this week. And but this report is fairly general and global in its recommendations. And Catherine Ryan did a relatively decent interview with Stuart Smith earlier in the week. And what she was focusing on and what the report focused on basically is who's going to pay for climate adaptation. And it's really quite concerning in terms of some of the principles that have been set out in this document, which I might say is last came out in August, which was the report of the expert working group on managed retreat, a proposed system for te hekinga rauora, or planned relocation. And that report first came out in August 2023, and it was updated in August 2024 and released, and it has 89 recommendations. So this recent report this week that's gone to the Parliamentary Select Committee seems to be largely based on that. So it's kind of an overview, and if you look at that earlier report, you get some more detail in terms of what's intended. So, and I can talk about this from the perspective of what's already out there and happening, because Capiti has had a very interesting exercise going on since 2022 on the adaptation plan. And a lot of these recommendations reflect some of what's been taking place, and I think Capiti is not alone in this. There are a lot of other councils that are developing co-adaptation plans at local government level. But on the questions is all going, from the earlier report, it says risk assessments are informed by tikanga and maturanga, inclusive of kaupapa Māori methodologies, including having experts in these matters for the area of the risk assessment included in the expert panels. And so this approach about the inclusion of maturanga Māori and te reo te ao Māori perspectives is right, and it's leading to things like the result, for example, in the Capiti CAP process, is that you've got the final report of the CAP process, which was presented to the council in June, contains in its introduction, supported by a social impact research, which covered some of the same area, is supported by statements which says that the that climate change is caused by feuding atua, which are the Māori deities, and that people must get out of those areas where the deities are enraged and feuding. So, you know, I mean, once again, we're...
Well, I mean, we sort of pay indulgences to the climate fairies, don't we? I mean, it's kind of opposite with the Western approach.
But more serious aspects...
We've in scientific terms, but it's very much a sacrifice to the climate gods.
Well, that's one aspect. And the other aspect, of course, is what commentators on the Capiti situation have raised, which is that... extreme scenarios are being used climate change projections and statistics, estimates of sea level rise, computer modelling, which mainly is coming from international agencies, are being used to create a fairly alarmist approach and a radical planning scenario. So the CAP report in Capity came out with, I think, 2.6 billion estimates worth of costs, which include everything from building seawalls to requiring people to raise the floor level of their houses or manage retreat. In this recent report that's gone to the parliamentary committee this week, sets out 11 principles. And they include, I mean, a lot of it is obvious things. And they're talking about, you know, who should bear the cost of climate adaptation. Other principles that they've got outlined include fairness and equity, transparency, subsidiarity, national consistency, clarity, accountability, and evidence-based decisions, which all sounds all right and proper. And these principles they're suggesting should be the basis for developing a future policy framework on climate adaptation. And so basically what they're wanting to do is get Parliament to sign off on these principles, and then the bureaucrats will go and beaver away on the details again. Well, there are two things in here that because what Catherine Ryan was trying to draw out of Stuart Smith was more detail about the who's going to pay and where is the compensation for property.
Oh, you've frozen there, Catherine. I wonder if you turn your video feed off. Try again.
Property, are you now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I could.
Okay. So two of the 11 principles that are set out in this document for the Finance and Expenditure Committee minimising moral hazard. And it said, situations should be avoided where property owners are disincentivised to manage risk because they do not face the full costs of risks materialising. So in other words, property owners should be putting into effect, you know, whatever, anticipating the climate change scenarios. And then fair warning. Individuals should be responsible for managing their own natural hazard risk when making decisions. The longer the information about the risk has been available, the less case there is for socialising the cost if the risk is realised. And that worries me in terms of now, Capity has a CAP report which has gone to the council, and they've said that they're not specifically using it for planning, but of course it's out there. So if there is an event where properties are funded and flooded and a compensation is being considered, are they going to say, oh, well, you know, we published all these detailed risks, so you've known and you should have taken action?
Computer said no.
Yes, and therefore... And therefore there's no compensation.
Yeah, reading through the Select Committee report, I couldn't help but reflect that when we need the coalition to stand up to the fetishes of the globalist neo-feudalist tide that's rising like the sea levels on their computer models, they never fail to disappoint. And as you said, it's all there, the equity, the Crown's partnership with Māori and their need for incorporation of mātauranga Māori into risk assessments. And I thought also, and this comes back to the reporting of it, I get an uneasy feeling that there's a fair amount of will to power couched in euphemistic language. For example, we recommend to the government that there should be a comprehensive national framework set out in legislation that established. So, yeah, as you say, they're talking about potentially, I mean, if you read between the lines, does it mean we're going to give councils the tools they need to herd Kiwis into 15-minute cities and force them off their land? Because that's what it sounds like to me. And I would hope that the media plays a bigger role, not only in quantifying the amount of money this is going to cost the country and the opportunity costs of it, but also the sneaky things that are being snuck in. Peter, have you got your eye on that as well?
Well, my only reaction to what Catherine's been talking about is whatever happened to personal responsibility. If you want to buy a property near the sea, then frankly, it is your responsibility. If it starts getting washed away, be well insured, talk to your insurance company, and your property should be your responsibility, not your next door neighbour's, not somebody who lives on the hill high above you. I'm very sceptical about socialising the damage that climate change might cause. And remember, it's all about might, could, may. There's no certainty here. If you want to live by the sea, you go live by the sea. But if the sea starts washing your place away, then too bad.
Take it up the Atua.
You lose. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, well, we'll leave the climate change there. We discussed earlier today on the political panel, but I'm interested to get your thoughts on the resentment of New Zealand's poor, underpaid media levies, the wounding they feel when contemplating the money that Christopher Luxon made selling two of his seven residential properties last month. I was reminded of Bob Jones's observation that a lot of the resentment of journalists comes from their modest salaries. So even modest sums of money seem like a fortune to them. There was a One News reporter, and I've looked for her name, but I couldn't find it.
It's Yvonne Tahana is the infamous woman's name. She was, when I was there, the Māori Affairs reporter. She appears to have gone on to become a general reporter. I don't know who put her up to that performance the other day, but it is quite extraordinary to be asking Christopher Luxon whether or not he thought it was a good idea to have Sky TV at Premier House in the apartment. I mean, how petty, how pathetic can you get? I don't think Christopher Luxon's a great sports fan. I don't think he could probably give a toss about whether or not...
He talks about sports ball all the time.
It's his
thing.
I'm sure he hasn't got the time to watch too much rugby on Sky. So if it was taken away, well, gosh, it saves the taxpayer, all of $100 a month, $1,200 a year. Well, big deal. But, you know, the absurdity of some of the questioning of Christopher Luxon by that woman was just beyond the pale, really. I imagine that she was probably put up to it by somebody more senior than her. So that person should take some responsibility as well. But getting back to the whole business of a capital gains tax, heaven forbid, doesn't this government already spend about $125 billion a year from its various revenue sources? I would far sooner it spent its money more wisely before it started collecting any more taxes.
Well said. Catherine?
Well, of course it was ridiculous and petty and... people talk about envy politics, and this is one thing that the Green Party really gets into. And they seem to have, you know, the idea that anybody who's rich enough to own property should be publicly castigated for making any out of it. And I mean, Christopher Luxon is perfectly entitled to own properties and sell properties, and if he makes any money out of it, well, it's nobody else's business. And most of the parliament, most of the MPs in parliament actually have property portfolios or own investment. Interesting debate than pointing the finger at Christopher Luxon and saying, oh, he's the prime minister, so he's already well paid, and why should he be making more money out of properties? Is just silly envy stuff. But what's again, you know, I constantly complain on this program that we never get unbiased and balanced coverage from the media. But a more interesting point to talk about would be the extent to which the taxpayer props up the private rental sector in New Zealand generally, and they do that in two ways. One is because if you run investment properties, you get tax cuts on your expenditure associated with those properties, and also the taxpayer pays for the accommodation supplement, which props up every private rental owner, owner of investment properties in the country.
Yeah, that's a point covering... you made well on Cam Slater's show, The Crunch. I remember listening to that. We're running out of time. So just before we close, and speaking of Green Party fetishes, that one of their consistent interests in driving down the age that people can vote at, and I see that Hastings District Council made the decision to appoint children or young people with voting rights onto council committees. Peter, this story seems custom-made for you to go full curmudgeon on. What are these young upstarts planning?
Well, be nice if they could vote properly in the elections. I find it extraordinary that they were able to vote, or they are going to be able to vote around council committees and therefore make decisions that the council will most likely rubber stamp without actually being able to vote in the elections for the people's representatives. As far as the media coverage is concerned, there didn't appear to be much of an outcry about it at all from the mainstream. It needed curmudgeons like myself to write substacks. It needed independent media, such as the platform David Farrow, the right-leaning blogs, to explain what the heck was going on here. The real problem, in my opinion, is the Local Government Act, which was passed over 20 years ago, which allows council committees to have appointees and not elected representatives. It never happens at Parliament. Central government select committees are only comprising elected representatives, and it's just a fault of the Local Government Act that other people from outside the elected representatives can be appointed to the council committees, and that should be changed by Local Government Minister Simeon Brown. But of course, there will be outrage from iwi, because that's how they sneak onto council committees through the back door. Mm. But no explanation of what council committees actually do and about the ramifications for democracy from the mainstream media that I've been able to see. And I think that is just yet another failing of mainstream media being unable to examine very important aspects of a democratic society.
Catherine, have you got your own curmudgeonly take on this?
Well, I have to 100% agree with Peter on this. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And of course, you know, we do have precedents with Māori appointees. And again, I go back to Kapiti Coast District Council as an example, where they recently decided on a Māori ward, but they decided on a Māori ward in addition to retaining an arrangement that they have with the three largest iwi in the Kapiti area, that they have appointed representatives on council committees and they have voting rights on those committees, although not on the full council. The interesting thing about that is that according to the council's own statistics, those three iwi only represent 30% of the Māori in the district who identify as Māori, which is something like 2,000 people, but those iwi are corporate businesses in their own rights, so you're basically giving unfettered access to council decision-making to corporate business interests, as well as, you know, I mean, under the guise of being iwi. And recently, when the council made its decision to...
Oh, you've cut out, Catherine. I haven't cut your mic.
They did that on the basis... I see the connection's unstable again. The council did that on the basis of a survey that they had done, and they said that support for a Māori ward was amongst people who are on the electoral roll, the Māori roll, and also the youth. And they decided that the youth were the future of the region, and so what they thought was very important. And so they voted for the Māori ward in addition to retaining the appointed representatives, with apparently no consideration other than Māori and young people supported it.
Yeah. I guess once again, we're not going to get a two-state solution. Maybe it's just not realistic.
Let me tell you a couple of things, Catherine and Marty. You know what? Youth will always be the future, and the present will always be the present. And the people who live here currently deserve just as many rights, if not more, than the futurists.
Well, Peter, that's an awesome place to close. I think we're pretty much out of time. We've covered a lot of ground, and I hope we've given our listeners a few Rosetta Stones to help them decode what they're seeing on the news. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're most welcome, Marty.
Thank you. And Peter, thanks to you also. Always a pleasure.
Good stuff, Marty. Nice to talk to you all.
You've been listening to The Fourth Estate right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.